Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Welcome to another edition of Holding Court. Court is now in session. I am joined by my co-host Vijay Pal. This is Dave McIsaac, and we are broadcasting live from the Junior Tennis Champion Center in College Park, Maryland. And today we have a special guest, Nick Little-Hales from the United Kingdom. He is the sleep coach, international elite sleep, sports sleeping recovery performance coach. He's been in the business for 25 years. He's worked with Real Madrid, Chelsea, Manchester United, Olympic teams. You name the big teams in the UK, and he's worked with them. Nick, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining us.
That's great, yeah. Love to be with you today.
Did we cover everything?
I think you did, yes. It was a very, very introduction, but appreciate it.
So we want to get right into it. I noticed in an interview you noted that one player's bedroom was set at 32 degrees Celsius. And so I was wondering, what's the most egregious sleep habit you've encountered so far?
I think principally, whether it's an elite sport or with anybody around the world, their awareness of good sleep hygiene, which is your habits, your routines, the protocols and interventions that you might use to maximize the way you sleep is very limited. So you do come across things where with modern day houses and with air conditioning or temperature control, insulation at certain parts of the world which are generally warmer, is that we tend to like to have the houses much hotter than we ever used to. And particularly when that translates into the bedroom, you're actually looking for something much lower. I think most people will sort of be aware of around 16 to 18 or certainly under 20 degrees for the bedroom is the right sort of temperature for going into a good sleep state from a normal body temperature. But when you get things like 30 plus degrees, you really are completely fighting this natural process. In fact, sometimes generated from when we are, first born moving from the womb. There's this white noise that is around us in so many different ways, from fans to all sorts of things that are around us. And this constant drone in the background, it can be very soporific for a lot of people. That's translated out into a couple of athletes over the period of time where they were actually found it very easy to fall asleep when their parents were hoovering or vacuuming the house. That constant drone from the vacuum cleaner had the same sort of effect. And so they would actually, in some cases, switch a vacuum cleaner on in the bedroom to create the same atmosphere.
So that was kind of their white noise.
That was their white noise, but it was also, you can download white noise sounds onto your smart device. You can get them in all sorts of different ways. But it was the association, not only with the sound, but within the process of vacuuming. So, in some cases, sleep can be an extremely sort of close familiarization process. If you've got certain things around you, it can be smells, can be pictures, it can be words, it can be just things that have been brought up through your infant years. These things can have people with sleep disorders that are there hour to be treated. But in general terms, nobody's actually educating anybody about simple sleep hygiene. Parents don't do it, so schools don't do it, universities don't do it. And so even doctors who we might see on a monthly or more regular basis have very little studying in that particular area. So there's more to do with, I come across a lot of doctors in every area of sport, and up until recently, I have to say, the first point of call, if you came along and said you're struggling to sleep, they would provide you with a pill, with a drug. And even running into the last Olympics 2012 in London, the Australian squads coming over, their Olympic authorities had to ban sleeping tablets before they left because it had become so prevalent in the sport. And last year I was involved with the Netherlands bobsleigh team running into Sochi 2014 Winter Olympics, and they were trying to get themselves off what had been pre-prescribed sleeping tablets because they'd become so dependent on them. If they didn't take a pill, they wouldn't be able to sleep. Now, I was able to move them away from that. And I think there's a lot of these factors. Although you've got some serious specialists out there and you've got a lot of experience, particularly within the armed forces where sleep and sleep coaches are there trying to help with the armed forces, I think with all of that, I still think you will have quite an expectation. And certainly some of the conversations I've had with athletes from baseball to NFL to basketball at this moment in time, I think the US will certainly want to embrace, you know, either the type of work that I do or somebody will pick up on it and translate it over there, because so many people just will not walk into a clinic or walk into a university because they don't actually believe they've got a problem. Most things are about sleep apnea. Even I've come across athletes who actually admit that they probably only get maybe 1 hour sleep a night, and they've been doing that for 4 or 5 years, but they wouldn't actually consider that to be a problem. So I think once you uncover, which is basically all I do, I go into their world, I uncover what they're doing, and within there you find all sorts of little things by, you know, just the amount of caffeine that they're taking on, because it's so available in so many different things these days, so they're getting overstimulated. The types of foods that they can get hold of to interact with them, which is negative and counterproductive to sleep. And there is a thing that everybody will be suffering from, particularly if any of your junior tennis players are listening to this. Certainly in certain sports it's more prevalent than others, but it's called electronic insomnia. And because we restrict the amount of daylight we get on a daily basis, it certainly gets worse, you know, around this time of year. The season effect of this storm is something people are aware of. And our exposure to natural daylight is becoming more and more restricted. We spend more time in and around artificial light, which opens up the effect too much of it and not enough daylight. And it's also maybe made even worse because we're now wandering around with portable devices which we can share at anywhere. And that is increasing the amounts of artificial light we've got. So that's stimulating and in newer levels of insomnia. And there is also the ability to sort of play your mates on the other side of the world, on Halo, whatever, gaming away to the early hours of the morning on a sort of global internet battle. So we've got gamers, we've got that as an entertainment thing that the younger generation, to put it like that, absolutely loves it. So you see a lot more people, they're being woken up quite early in the mornings to maximize their days. They're going much longer past 12, towards 1 o'clock, towards 2 o'clock, because they're simply being overstimulated, and then they'll crash and then do the boring
there was a historic match in your neck of the woods, the 2010 Wimbledon against John Isner versus Nicholas Mahut. It was set the record for the longest tennis match of all time. It was 11 hours, 5 minutes, over 3 days. So I'm sure you remember that, hearing about that one and maybe seeing all of it over the course of the 3 days. How would you advise these athletes, either, you know, in that match, which is a very rare situation, but even an athlete that's got to play at a high level, you know, a game this day and then another game the next day and maybe a third game the next day, how would you advise them to get their sleep? Because sometimes they're, you know, maybe they have to play early in the morning the next day, maybe they have a shifting schedule. Is it a matter of just get as much possible sleep as you can, or should you try to be consistent in each night and only get a set number, or what's your advice to an athlete that's got to, you know, stick to that tough schedule?
I think without treating the question with a little bit of generalization or vague, the individuals can follow an individual plan, and some people would adopt sleeping for long periods of time. Trying to, in some respects, bank some extra sleep in case it gets disrupted. Principally, the way I work with it is because when you're working with, say, a single-handed round-the-world sailor, and they're going to leave port on their own out at sea for a very long time, and the only time they can ever consider to go and take a very short, pre-controlled 20, 30, 40-minute period asleep on board the yacht is when a certain number of factors are in place. Not just one of them, a certain number of factors. Once they're all in place, they can leave the station of the boat. So that might not happen for quite a few days. So you have to train somebody to go into a particular event. So if they're going into something, like Wimbledon, they have a schedule of matches. They know where their opportunities are to take on sleep. And there's also opportunities during the course of every day, not just at night, when they can take on sleep. So in some respects, if I apply the same technique that would to individual athletes going into an Olympic Games, for instance, it's because the pressure starts to build, because their adrenaline and excitement and nervousness about going into an event like that starts to go to a much higher level. It becomes more difficult for them to actually sleep because they're so wired. So what you do is you go through a process of actually reducing the length of time they sleep, increasing it by jumps. So you go back to a very natural process of all human beings have inside us. We've just tried to remove it as much as possible. Some countries still adopt this siesta period. It's going back to pre-sleeping periods in any 24 hours. So you would have a shorter nocturnal period. You would also get another one midday between 1 and 3, which is totally natural, where your need and urge bounces. And there's another one between 5 and 7. So you would encourage, like those two players who have gone into that event, they do not know that it's going. They know it can all easily go 5 sets. They know it can do that, and that's quite common. So they prepare for that, but they wouldn't prepare to be there for 3 days. So those guys would have, if they're going into that particular pressurized situation, if that long, they would use much shorter, quicker boosts than that period we call them. Controlled sleeping periods where you literally do it, in a 20 or 30 minute period, that will boost and balance without creating this deficit or desire to sleep for any longer periods. Physical recovery can be dealt with in so many different ways these days rather than just being in a sleep state. So you combine those two things together so somebody can actually go for quite a long period of time just having short bursts rather than great big long ones, which can be, in my experience, quite counterproductive.
Well, thank you, Nick, for your insights today. We appreciate you coming on the program. You can follow Nick on Twitter with the handle @SportsSleepCoach or check out sportsleepcoach.com. Thanks again, Nick. Hope to talk to you soon.
Thank you, Nick.
Have a great day. Cheers, Chris. Bye.
Maravillosa y dulce viento, pasa y dame tiempo de tu tiempo, dame aliento y continuaré viendo cómo sigue.